build on here and get done on time. So that'd be May 23rd. So, do you vote on that now or just take it as a presumption? We are going to discuss a number of things today. We're going to talk about the CCDSs. The House has a version. The Senate has a version. And I think just for the technical discussion, maybe I'll have Mr. Chun just describe what the House does, and the Senate can describe, and sort of the population served. And we're going to stop at 10, whatever happens. And the Senate has finance meeting at the same time, and so we may lose some of them, which... And the purpose of our discussion is not for us to hear us talk about our thing, but to have the Senate hear it. So if they have to run off, then we'll have to just take a little break, and we'll respect that. Anyway, so Mr. Chun, and then maybe the Senate counter, we'll actually have a few questions about that, and the Senate counterpart can describe what they did, and then we'll see how far we get. Mr. Chun, Chairman, Senator.
Mr. Chair, and just wanted to ask Mr. Chung, I'm sure he will, but just could you make a reference in the side-by-side where the language is so you can take a look at that?
Sure, we can do that.
Thank you.
Mr. Chair and members, the CCDS language in the House and also for the Senate can be found in Article 5. It's House Section 86, Senate Section 38, and the following sections. So this would be page R84. Of the Article 5 comparison bill. Basically, both the House and the Senate sort of reinstate the CCDS system to serve general assistance, medical care, enrollees. And the comparison summary, you know, goes over some of these differences. There are differences, for example, in when the CCDS system starts up, and that's sort of tied to when the House and Senate, repeal the early MA expansion. So I'll go over some of the differences in the House position from the previous CCDS system. First of all, the House allows county-based purchasing plans to establish a CCDS. The House language also gives some direction for CCDS contracting with providers. It requires a CCDS to give preference to healthcare homes when contracting with providers. It also requires a CCDS to contract with federally qualified health centers and FQHC lookalikes and also essential community providers as long as they agree to the same, you know, contract terms as other providers. There's also language in the House bill that requires payments to FQHCs to be in accordance with federal law, which would mean, you know, cost-based reimbursement. The House bill also requires the commissioner to negotiate enrollment thresholds with each CCDS and to pay CCDSs in proportion to these thresholds. Unlike the previous CCDS system, there is no extra, 10% payment to certain hospitals operating CCDSs. And also payment isn't based in proportion to the old GAMC enrollment served by an entity. The House does not reinstate the prescription drug pool. So in other words, outpatient prescription drugs would be part of what a CCDS would provide, and the CCDS would have to pay for this out of their payment rate. And in contrast, the Senate, I believe, reinstates this pool. And finally, I think both the House and the Senate do not reinstate the uncompensated care pool.
And just for the math of it, I think the House puts $400 million toward this. And I think the population served is the 90,000. Is that right, Mr. Walz?
Mr. Chair, the potential could be 90,000. I think the department has stated they're not positive how many people would walk into the CCDSs, so it's difficult to say exactly the amount of people that would serve.
Right, okay, and that's, I think that's helpful to know. Okay, any questions about that from the Senate? Senator.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, and I guess, and thank you, Mr. Chung, for the review. And I think it was, I don't know that we have to have a separate presentation of the Senate position. I think you covered it. They're very similar. There are some differences, and I don't know if our counsel wants to make any comments. I certainly would welcome that. It was at least our intention in the Senate as we did this. We reinstated the CCDS structure, frankly, as in conjunction with the idea that the expansion, early expansion of Medicaid was counterproductive to some of the reform efforts that we saw that were occurring in the CCDS program. And a concern about just reinstating and expanding that Medicaid structure to encompass that population would, in fact, remove the incentives for the kinds of innovation that we saw were at least in some fashion occurring in the CCDS world. We also recognize that the CCDS structure as it had been in place was not perfect, that there were challenges that need to be addressed. Partly it is recognition that we may need to put some more funding into that. We in our site, I think, had allowed for about $450 million. So, again, a similar number, but a little bit more than the House plan. It was my intention to continue this discussion about the structure into the conference committee with the hopes that we could continue to entertain some ideas on how that structure should be crafted in the statutes. And I have had conversations offline with hospitals associations, for example, about what are some of the things that might need to be done to make this a more effective program. I think what our bill as it's written pretty much takes the existing language and just brings it over. But I certainly am wanting to go on record here in the conference committee to say that's not to suggest that we are not interested in looking at ways to improve that. And so all I would say is that as we talk about this issue, I hope that we can take some testimony from hospitals and others about this and see if there are things that we could do together, agree together, to make this a stronger program. So, and I don't know, does the Senate Counsel want to make any comment about what we've got in the bill?
Mr. Chair and Senator Hanna, I think you're correct. The one thing that, just to point out, is that our effective date is October 1st, 2011. And the only other difference is in the current program is we allow hospitals or groups of hospitals, any hospital or group of hospitals, to become a CCDS. And we do continue to allow the commissioner to limit the enrollment thresholds and financial liability, which is in the current or was in the current program. Other than that, it is you indicated.
And Senator and members in public, the one feature that the House did as a way to try to improve it was to increase the number of sites by using the FQHCs as a frontline sites. Where in the past, the hospitals actually did not include, to the extent I would have liked, those sites as primary entry points. And to their credit, the hospitals, in fact, created the equivalent of that inside of their own walls with some tremendous success about the people they served at Hennepin and Regions and elsewhere. So I think that was, I think if we would have done that in the beginning, it would have been more successful, and the money was, of course, very, very lean. So just to help me understand I don't understand the Senate proposal on all the health care part, which we'll discover later, but on the CCDS portion of the under 75% of poverty group, is that you still, the $450 million serves the same 90-some thousand, more or less, group of people. And is that correct, Senator?
Mr. Chairman, yes. We have had the same conversation with the department on the numbers. It's a little unclear exactly, as Mr. Walt said, what the number is. But it is intended, at least in our view, to serve the population that arguably may not, for a variety of reasons, be in a position to take advantage of other kinds of health insurance options that are out there. And so I think that this structure is designed to provide a more structured, managed care approach to a certain population. And for, convenience of definition, it's been defined as 75% of federal poverty or below. Yeah. And we're not fixed on that as, well, that's what it has to be. Yeah. We're certainly open to having discussions about how that population ought to be described or who should be included or what the numbers are. Those, to me, are all things that, that I think as we look at this particular portion of the bills to see how do we make this better. Yeah. I think it's good that you have it in your bill. The House has it in their bill, so that we can at least say, how do we craft this in a way that is an improvement, hopefully, from where we
were. Oh, sure. Yeah, and I'm not being critical in any way. I'm just trying to understand what you did, and just so we can compare. And so in the Senate bill, there was no prescription drug pool either, right? You just took the $450 million as a lump, as a block to spend, however, right?
No, Mr. Chair, we reinstate the prescription pool.
As part of the $450 million?
I believe a certain percentage, how it was set up originally in the old one, is that a certain percentage of the CCDSs take a certain percentage of their payment, or they have to pay in a certain percentage into the pool, and that's how that is financed.
So the total pot of money is $450 million for doing all the work.
Right.
I'm just trying to get the big picture. So, Representative Gottwald.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm glad that we have this position in both the Senate and the House. I think one of the things we've acknowledged, even under the early MA approach that's currently in place, is that we want to go back to the reforms that we identified, that hospitals both in-state and out-state have identified as the proper way to care for these people at 75% below, is to do that early intervention and preventive care and maintenance of regimen. And so we know we can do that. We know we need to do it. And I appreciate the return to focusing on that in this approach. One thing that concerns me a little bit, and I'm hoping somebody on staff can maybe help us with the numbers, is we keep hearing this 90,000 number. In the past, I've heard it's actually slightly lower, and that the number actually refers to encounters or episodes of care rather than unique individuals. I think the number of actual individuals in the state is a much smaller number, and I'm not trying to minimize the need. And again, I believe there's still some uncertainty about how many would access the CCDSs around the state, but I think it's important that we get a little clearer on those numbers so that we're not, you know, these numbers get thrown around rather generously, I think, and we need to be real honest about what they represent as we look at this situation. The number of people who need this care under a CCDS system may in fact be somewhat smaller, and I would agree with Representative Abler, we probably underfunded the old fix, if you will, but I think properly done, this is the way that we should be delivering care to people at 75% below.
Well, maybe I saw Mr. Greenman in the audience. Maybe this, if he knows the numbers off the top of his head or some other.
He's shaking his head.
He doesn't know off the top of his head. Maybe the department could just provide us. And the number seems to grow depending upon what news report you're hearing. It's above 100,000, I heard at one point, and I think it's approaching a million if you're not careful. So we'd like to have real numbers that we can all have the same ideas. I represent Kiffmeyer and then Huntley.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. And one of the differences between the House and the Senate is that the House position says participation by hospitals or plans, and that's in the House and not in the Senate. And I think it might be helpful to explain why the inclusion of or plans.
Maybe I'll let Mr. Chun comment about that.
Mm-hmm. Mr. Chair, Representative Kiffmeyer, that's related to the House position where we allow community-based plan to, or I'm sorry, county-based purchasing plan to operate a CCDS. So we've added references to plans meeting a county-based purchasing plan throughout the section of law.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I think that helps clear that.
Oh, good. Representative Huntley.
Mr. Chair, we should also, I think, have the department tell us what they're spending on these people right now in the early enrollment.
All right.
And what the federal match is, that sort of thing.
Right, and for the department hear that as well. So maybe next time we meet, they can conjure up a sheet about the enrollment and what the projected current spending is, and all sources, both federal and state. So that would be very helpful. A good question. Senator Hand.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And just a comment to Senator Kiffmeyer, Representative Kiffmeyer's comment. Yes, the Senate position, we do not have the county-based purchasing plan included in our bill. we are certainly open to talk about this and in the course of discussing how this ought to be constructed. So the fact that it isn't there, excuse me, does not mean that we are not, as I indicated before, open to have a pretty broad discussion about how this this provision ought to be constructed. As I said, I have had some conversations offline here with the representatives from the hospitals and representatives with the plans. I think there are issues with the current, or at least the old structure of the CCDS that we need to continue to work on. I know, for example, that there's concern about a high-end risk. If we assign people to be cared for in these structures and someone comes in and they have to have, a heart transplant or something, how do you deal with that? And I think there are some things that we should contemplate or perhaps take testimony on. How do we manage that kind of risk, and how do we do that in the confines of this structure? I think the other thing I want to just comment on to Representative Huntley's point, I don't think we have in our bill, maybe, and I don't know if you do, but we don't have any waiver language associated with this structure. And so I don't know that we're contemplating using federal dollars to support the CCDS explicitly. We may want to consider that. We may want to say perhaps the use of the Medicaid monies, instead of just reinstating an existing Medicaid structure, if we can find a way to do this, perhaps we ought to seek some assistance or some permission, if you will, from the federal government to let us use those funds to augment the dollars that we have in place. And I don't know if that's in your position. I don't think it's in ours. But again, if we're going to have a discussion about this, I would entertain or advocate that we have a pretty far-reaching discussion about how to do this in a way that is really going to be an improvement.
Other questions from members? Let me offer a comment, and I think we'll move on to the next topic then. And the to the senator's point, the deadlines were early for moving our bills out, but I think you'll notice on the House side there's lots of ideas salted through that can be expanded upon, and there's been a good number of discussions in the hallway and in my office with various entities coming forward to embrace some of the concepts there. And I would encourage the members and staff and the public and the department to not get hung up on a sentence on a piece of our side-by-side, but to look and see what can be done. I talked to the department yesterday, so I'm not talking out of school on this. I was hoping in the health policy bill there would have been some language talking about coordinating these high-cost people. That was some of the lessons that were learned in the CCDS model. And even though every hospital that did it lost money, they lost way less money because they coordinated the care. And push came to shove, and they had to find a way to do their own in-hospital versions. And I commend the four hospitals for taking the risk. And I think North Memorial is reeling the worst from having done the right thing. But what was learned in the CCDSs at Hennepin and Regions in particular is that they saved 20 to 25% of the money and had better outcomes by actually doing what should have been done all along. And I don't see any language but maybe what's in our bills here that will capture that. And so, my position on the repeal is I think that it's just to go back, I didn't support it. I mean, I didn't support the early expansion and the repeal of CCDS is just carte blanche because of the loss of that reform. And reform itself isn't good or bad, but the improvement to the services, the improvement to the outcomes, the stability of the population, and the less burden on our budget, which is stressed at both the federal and state levels. And so to the senator's idea, I've been thinking about this, and he verbalized what I've been thinking. If you think about the House being the floor at $400 million, which is admittedly a lean number, and I'm not going to defend that it's not tight, the 450 is a little better, but still lean. If you take the Representative Huntley's point about what's the total investment, probably the net is around $1.6 billion. After you take out DISH and some of the stuff, that's my just round number. So you have a range of between $400 million and $1.6 billion. And $1.6 billion includes a lot of waste, a lot of churn, a lot of valueless services to people who have not been managed like we did before. And if we created a CCDS model, if we could get a waiver to do this program, be it global or more finite sized, to let us run these people how we choose and get the money, and if you created a CCDS model built with hospital buy-in and FQHCs and primary care for $1 billion, $1.2 billion, they would think they'd died and gone to heaven based on time before, which represents a savings $400 to $600 million in the biennium, which half of a year, 1 year is $300 million, $200 million. And the out years become considerable savings with better outcomes. And so I would urge the people listening to this, both members, staff, the department, and the audience, that if you think this is only tied to some mythical effort to repeal early MA, I would disabuse you of that notion, that we are absolutely focused on getting value for the $1.6 billion or the $1 billion or the $400 million we're going to spend on serving the people that we all care about. So just wanted to let you know that. And there's been a lot of activity going on about that very thing. And I really appreciate that, both at, you know, the offline department level, but also with some of the private sector entities who would be affected by this. So, Rep. Huntley, I think you're pushing the discussion the right way, and I appreciate that. And you want to comment?
I just had a question about the Senate language. I'm looking at the spreadsheet, and this program has continued after January 1, 2014, which is not in accord with federal law.
Senator Hamm.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, and Representative Huntley. Well, we have taken the position that the status of the federal law is uncertain, and certainly not, in my mind, a certainty that that law, as it is written today, will go into effect in 2014. Other parts of our bill, Senator Nino, had a provision that we adopted that suggests that we oughtn't to assume that until it's been found to be constitutional. And I think, frankly, that beyond just that provision more broadly, that we ought to be very cautious about assuming that the federal law and act on it as if it were going to go into effect when its status is very uncertain. I think that there is some risk to that, and the provision that we adopted that Senator Nino brought makes that explicit, that we shouldn't do that until it is clear that that is a constitutional provision. So, yes, that's true, but it reflects the position that we're taking, that the status of that federal law is not certain.
The law.
Fair enough. Any other questions about the CCDS? I think in a future meeting, Representative Kiffmeyer.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I think in regards to that issue, that is a 2014. Our primary budget here is 12-13, and the next legislature can adjust that date. But I think in the light of the information we have now, there are a variety of dates that we may put in here that may have an effect, but that the next legislative session is readily able to deal with.
And I think probably at the end of the day, that'll be a subject of discussion and negotiation with the governor's office about what happens in the out biennium. And we have a little ways to go. We're not yet at total agreement with the administration, I would say, but I think we're moving that way. Any additional questions on the CCDS part? I think at one of our future meetings, we want to look at the treatment of the people above 75. The House has the Gottwald House File 8 version of the House. The Senate has taken that and expanded considerably, and we'll hear about that maybe, I don't know, today, or but at least in a future time. There was a question from the Senate about our disability approach, and I'll discuss it, and I don't know how much content you want, but there's a philosophy behind it. And then if the department wants to comment, if they think they need to, or if staff wants to fill in some gaps. Okay. But let me just take a stab at it in the beginning. And I think that the approach the House has taken is prudent. There's thinking the governor's office and the departments have to operate under the presumption that they're going to get $2-point-something billion in new revenue. And that's appropriate when they come up to the table. They have to stick with that position. Even though if we polled the people in this room and I'd ask you how much money you think you're getting in new revenue, I bet it would be a number lower than that. And so they're somewhat hamstrung in what they can say publicly, and I respect that, and we're not putting them in a position to have to go against our governor, and a man who I respect quite a bit, by the way. The House and the Senate have taken the position that there's not going to be that new revenue coming, and we've been given targets that are based upon zero new revenue, at least in any significant way. And the House target is even deeper than the Senate by $50 million. And so then how are you going to manage all our programs given those targets, which I believe are closer to a real number than the governor's proposal that was brought forward to us? And that's yet to be resolved at levels far above this conference group. And when that gets resolved, we can, you know, move forward in more earnestness with the governor and all that. But part of that is to recognize the reality of what is. And I have to say, I mentioned before, I commended those private entities and offline discussions about recognizing the reality of what CCDS might look like as a future plan that may work, or how do you manage these folks, whatever you call it. We just use that name as a moniker that we understand. I don't care what it's called. I don't care how it's described. I don't care how little or big a waiver is to accomplish that. But Minnesota needs the flexibility. In the same way we talked about healthcare with higher cost providers, lower cost providers, in the disability world, there is very little state uniformity in how the level of need is determined for people with disabilities, be they on an elderly waiver or on a TBI or DD waiver or any of those waivers, and it's kind of sort of random. And you have counties that are generous, even workers in counties who are more generous than other county workers in the same county. You have some who are more stingy or frugal, whichever term you would use. Then you have the bell curve. And I'm convinced if we could give people, if we would remove the higher level and need determinations that provide little value to the individual except to consume services, there's enough money in that system to serve everybody, even the 4,000 people who are outside waiting to get in. And there are some real crisis stories in that 4,000-person group. Mothers who are 80 years old as a sole surviving parent, a child who's 50, and she's not doing well, and all that. And so how do we address all that? But there's a lot of denial going on, and I get letters from, I won't burden you with the name of the group. Just yesterday I got a letter from somebody who's worried about the rollbacks and all these cuts, and they're worried, and we need to keep all the money intact. It's not real. It is not real to think you're going to get the full forecast spending on what is coming. The forecast growth is predicted to be $2.4 billion, $2.4 billion in the biennium, and there's no way to get that money. Even the governor, with a $4-point-something billion increase, reduced spending by $800 million in our department, which would be a cut under the view of whoever wrote this letter to me. I'm not going to embarrass you by telling you the name of your group. But I've got a bunch of letters like this. Please don't do it to us. Do what to us? And so the House has taken the position that we want to create funding that's stable, predictable, and serves the people who need it in ways that's going to be productive. So the House has done a number of things. The current value of the House spending target is in fiscal 12. We froze the numbers. The maintenance effort number is March of 2010. If you freeze it at that level, to get that money going forward becomes part of the next biennium's number. And so the House number is actually an increase over the current biennium. I don't recall the exact number. But it's an increase over what we're spending today. And so the thought of draconian cuts coming out of the House thing is totally wrong. And I'll tell you, this is the high water mark for money. And so if you didn't like this one, they should say thanks for trying. Because it's only going to get more stringent on how we decide to allocate the monies as we get targets and move into blending the two bills together. But the idea is multiple fold. The current way we treat people on a DD waiver is they land into a place, they live happily ever after in the same place, and they get to do DT&H and then retire, and then they get cost plus inflation to live there and become maybe nothing of what they could have become if they were pushed a little bit harder to more independence. A model that I've liked a lot, it comes from Mary T. in Coon Rapids. I used to represent them in my turf. But then all their neighbors, and very good neighbors, and very devoted to the care of their individuals. They put everybody on a discharge plan. And the idea is, are we the right vendor? Is this the right site? Can they do with less services? Can they be pushed to more independence? Some of the people get down to the point of 4 hours of independent living with SILS independent living skill services. Just and they have a pretty good life of it. And they if they do bad, they bring them back and do more. But the assumption that they can't improve at all is a wrong assumption. I think not respectful to the population. And so some people are never going to get more independent. They have a brain injury that they're totally needing life support. Well, for heaven's sakes, we're not going to take them off life support. But I'll tell you, if those people would be given a divergent level of need determination by 87 different counties, we can't. Nobody would say, let's give them all the highest level of service somebody could conjure up, because they're afraid of an appeal. So let's find what makes the most sense. Let's work on best practices, which I've been talking about for 8 years now, which has not been done. And now push has come to shove. And we still have 4,000 people outside waiting to get in. So not to preach, but you have to understand the philosophy that goes into this. So how do we work towards serving the people we all care so much about, that we know that are our neighbors, or that every district has a group of these individuals living there and hoping to thrive? So what the House has done, it's talked about creating twice a year evaluations, a level of need determinations, and if they're not going to change, it's only once a year. Or even, why bother if they're not going to, don't burden the system. But if you don't, I have teenage sons and they're growing up now, but if I don't push them, they're going to enjoy their life of not having to pick up the yard. And then I go help them to learn to pick up the yard. And in the same way, individuals could be challenged to a higher level of functioning and a better life if we told them that was something that was attainable. And so as we have to lean up their care plan, if we there's a conference with the county staff, with the social service director and the case manager or designees, to see what would be a reasonable number. And with the PCA changes, you know how much contention there was about that. Everybody appealed because they felt bad about it. What if they're on a discharge plan that said, you can become more independent. We're going to try a little less care. We love you. We want you to succeed. Try it and try. Give me 2 weeks. Call me back. Tell me how it went. That's the point of these informal conferences, to let them be pushed toward better. More services isn't better in every case. Some people are underserved, and we better correctly serve them, and I'm all for that. There's enough money in the House plan to do that very thing. We even created a 5% pool of money to handle crisis needs that got missed in the process. So it's very humane and it's very compassionate, putting people on a path to as much independence as is possible. And so there's a number of parts in the House bill, one of which is to the elderly waiver is fully funded at forecast levels, so don't think that's been reduced in the House plan. And all the rest of the waivers are funded at mid-012 numbers to achieve the 2010 maintenance effort that we had to maintain. And so with better attention, and also Lutheran Social Services has come up with some plans to create more focus on the case management is a mess. I've been frustrated with this my whole career here. And it's being divided in the House bill to administrative services and service coordination. And so if the people can control their own services better, which is the Lutheran Social Services model, which the House includes, then what services they get, they can be better run. There's some people who live on 30% of the services that they could have gotten because they can self-coordinate them and do better with some of the programs that they're on. For heaven's sakes, there's a message in this. And so if we can serve all the people and have more focused care, that's the vision I have. And I encourage the people in the audience who are concerned about that to recognize our passion and compassion for this population group, and to be realistic in what they ask us to accomplish. And so that's just the philosophy of it, and I think I mentioned some of the money too. So I think I've covered most of the points. Okay. In terms of, I think the House says, so it's better determination of need, more local coordination of the care plan that you do get, put people on a discharge plan, which is not discharge out of the waivers, but discharge to a different site.
Self-sufficiency.
Get to more self-sufficiency as much as is possible. If it's impossible, we understand that. There's money for that. So with that, I'll stand for questions and comments. Senator.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I appreciate that. And I want to ask counsel maybe to, just review our position as it contrasts to the House position And Mr. Lobaco, if you could just briefly.
Yeah, please. That'd be very appropriate.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, Senator Hanna, members of the committee. The Senate position is that we, the Senate, actually stops the growth in waivers in terms of the enrollment, both for TBI, CAC, CADI, and disability development. And I believe, I'll need to check real quickly, but I believe the elderly waiver limits the growth, similar to the governor. I'll need to double check that if you can give me just one moment.
Sure. Mr. Chair and Mr. Yes, Beck, I think that's true. And I guess I just wanted to point that out, that we do have different numbers in the spreadsheet. We do address this issue in a different way. And again, I just want to make the comment that we are certainly willing to talk about how do we do this better. I think that you clearly had, perhaps in your committee, had some discussion about how to do this differently or do this better. I don't know that we had spent as much time on that particular issue in the Senate. I think, again, we ought to entertain reform ideas. How can we do better with the money that we have? I agree with you generally, the point that you're making, that there are limits to the funds that we have available to us. There will always be limits. There is no possible way under any budget projection or under any budget idea that we will possibly be able to meet the projections that we have in the budget this year or as we contemplate future years. It's just we need to do something about the structure that we have and put it into a position where we can say with a straight face that this is sustainable and manageable under reasonable expected revenue growth that comes with an economy that is growing at some reasonable rate. And we need to do that. So we're certainly willing to talk about how do we structure this, how do we make it better, how do we do it differently. So even though we have different numbers, and as Mr. Lobaco said, we've just taken the position that we're not going to permit further growth, we're certainly willing to have discussion about how to do it differently.
Yeah, I appreciate that. And I see your fiscal person has stepped out. Mr. Wallace, can you just comment on that? I think our evaluation, I think we had a less total number of spending in our bill than the Senate did for waivers and so on. At least before we leave, come up with just the relative valuation? Because I think you were richer in your benefits set than we were. Oh, Mr. Lobaco, yeah.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Was that your department? Okay, go ahead.
Senator Hanna, members of the committee, I was incorrect. The waiver is also, we stopped the Senate position is to stop the growth in the waiver
as well.
Okay. In the elderly waiver.
Okay. Representative, so you can work on, it'd be interesting to know the calculation of it, just so we can, and I'm asking questions only to understand. We're not judging anything. Representative Kiffmeyer.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I think while the numbers are being sought, I think just a comment that this is one of those things that, as we've all been out and about in our communities, certainly mine as well, that I've seen this migration from institutionalization to the mainstreaming and doing all of this. But what's really exciting now, and even in my own local community, is to see them graduating. And the statement always was in the beginning, you know, to move on their way out to become like everybody else, to be able to function. That always was the goal, not to be permanently in a new kind of institutionalization. It was to make them as much a part of our communities as possible, and we've all been better off for that. In my local area, they're very excited. They have people that are at that stage now. They are becoming almost very minimally supported, but independent. It's been fun to see them at events, their social skills, their ability to function, their dress, their mannerisms, and everything else. It's just really exciting to see the tremendous progress. And they've gotten better at doing it. And I think if we allow them to keep getting better at doing it or nudge them along that way and be supportive in that regard, that is the kindest thing that we can do. Even if we had the more money, it would not be a kind thing to do to just take the easy way and just spend more money or do more things when really caring about them is putting the kind of effort and labor of love into helping to surround the circumstances. I mean, that is that kind of tough love genuine heart that is at that for them because you believe in their future. And it speaks more kindly to their capabilities that you see that future for them. And that's a good thing for us to do. So I think that there's even My Life, My Choices, and it's exciting to see this as we move through the process and to see that because of our care and compassion for them. But it needs to be reflected also in the fiscal and the policy. And I think our House position, I believe, will be very constructive to that, Senator. And so I'm very glad to see the amenability to merging these things together, because I think it will be a very very good and very positive result.
Rep. Sangalo, thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Just to build a little bit on Representative Kiffmeyer's comments, Mr. Chair and members, you know, this position on both the Senate and the House's part acknowledges one reality, first of all, and that's that we have been making promises we can't keep with money we don't have, and we have got to stop it. It is as disingenuous and irresponsible to tell people we're going to continue giving you things that we have no way of paying for long term as it is to refuse them care that they need. And I've made that statement many times. And so the first reality we're acknowledging is that we have to be able to bring this in line with the resources that are available to us, to live within our means so we can make promises we can keep and keep the promises that we make. The second piece of that Representative Abler spoke to very eloquently is that we know that with the same amount of money or a slight increase, not Machiavellian cuts, but same or slightly more money, we can do better. We can actually deliver better care. And this crisis, if you want to call it that, is moving us to do that finally. We haven't seen those reform-minded ideas before because the thought was always, well, we'll just add a little bit more. We'll keep the status quo going. We'll continue to add people to programs, make people more dependent on more public programs. And now, because of this fiscal reality, we're being required to come to grips with how do we do a better job? What are the other models? What has our experience over the last couple of decades taught us about how we deliver better care more efficiently, more effectively, and, oh, by the way, increase people's sufficiency to the extent possible? And this is the opportunity that we cannot miss. That's what this conference committee is about, in my mind, is dealing with that fiscal reality in a very responsible way, and using that as an opportunity to improve care to people, not hurt people, not throw them off of things, but put them on a better track. And I know that's scary. Change is always scary. But if we don't take this opportunity, and I call it an opportunity, not a crisis, to change what we're doing and bring it more in line with our fiscal reality, then we will continue making promises we cannot keep to people who simply cannot afford for us to do that. There are clearly people who need strong safety nets in this state, and we do them no favors by promising them a safety net we cannot deliver. And then there are other people, as Representative Abler pointed out, and I think Representative Han agrees, that we can begin doing a much better job for. And, oh, by the way, we end up saving money doing it, which allows us then to deliver care to others who haven't been getting it. That's the approach we need to take, and I think that's a nonpartisan position. I would hope we have agreement with the governor's office, with the DFL, and with obviously our caucus on those positions. So that's the opportunity I see in this conference committee and the opportunity with our conference committee report.
Thank you. Other comments from members? I was just going to do some quick math here. The Senate target is $90 million, according to Mr. Walz, of a reduction off the forecast. The House is $148.3 million off the forecast. The residual spending in the House is still $2.45 billion, and that looks to me like about a 6% reduction. I was just going to do it real quick here. But $6.04. Anyway, That's off the forecast, just so you know. So,
Mr. Chairman, that's just helpful now. Those numbers again?
Yeah, the total. I'm going to use the word reductions. I have a hard time using the word cut when there's still growth. But you can semanticize this all day, and I'm not trying to be clever. But the reduction in forecasted growth in the Senate is $90 million. The reduction in forecasted growth in the House is 148.3. The forecasted spending altogether is $2.6 billion, roughly, in all waivers for the biennial. So you can do your own math. There's some questions. That's some more.
Do you want to wait till she comes?
Is that it's not interesting. So, okay. I think we have a little bit of time left. Any more questions about waivers? Did we satisfy the assignments question? The letter from Leech Lake?
Yeah. That one just came out.
Oh, okay. Okay. Something else in a related way, Senator, that wasn't on the list, but the county redesign, you're familiar with that from the past. And related to how you help manage waivers and do the county's work, is the House spent a fair amount of time. The Senate had the burden of policy and finance together, so I can't imagine that job with doing both those, so I commend you for surviving that. But we had a little more time to do some digging into the county redesign. And I was part of that earlier, too, so it was just a natural thing to continue it on. Representative Thiessen did it in the past. And so there was this creation in a couple of years ago of these units called service delivery authorities in which counties were not so much the metro, but the smaller outstate counties were the greater Minnesota counties were encouraged to band together and get some economies of scale. And the number that they came up with was 55,000 citizens or individuals in a county would be the critical mass. And so the House, and there's some movement, they're working on outcomes, and it's moving forward at a snail's pace. In this, knowing the money's going to be less for the counties in anybody's proposal, be they county aides or the whole, these monies here or whatever, it seemed to me that we should give them more flexibility if they would band together and let them run their own county. The outcomes are coming. They're doing work groups and they're creating outcomes, and I'm on one of the groups that's supposed to be looking after that, and we meet rarely, but they're working. And I think it's a success story about how to get more product out of all those hardworking counties. And the counties are our front line of service. We're a delegated state. And so what the House is proposing on the county part is that those counties who will then join into an SDA by January 1st of 2012, which means they have to get the joint powers agreements, all their labor issues, and we're working on labor issues behind the scenes trying to come up with a plan about how that could be accommodated, because it can be a real barrier to counties wanting to join together. If they would come together with a size that's appropriate, they could inform the commissioner that they are an SDA and then would be, without any approval from the commissioner, would be then just be given, they'd become an SDA for the purpose of social and human service functions. And they would then be able to be relieved of a number of maintenance effort requirements and have much more flexibility with the money they have to serve the people that they're to serve. And it's nice to have outcomes and accountabilities, but the accountability at the county level is very close to the people. The commissioners are there. They are running around town drinking coffee and doing their daily business because they live there. They have very capable social service, human service staff. They have a social service director who does nothing but worry about the needs of their citizens. They're very interested in the money. They're interested in the service. If they have more money, they serve more people. If they're a little shorter, they decide what's essential. And if they plow the roads with the leftovers and fix the highways. And so it seems like if we gave them the freedom that we think Washington should give us to run their own locale, that they would actually be pretty good at that. And that's the assumption that's built into the SDA part of the bill. And maybe I want to make these meetings productive. Maybe, is it Mr. Chung that has that? Do you have the service delivery, or is that Ms. Aves? Ms. Aves, you just want to run through the high. I didn't give you preparation for this. I know you have it memorized, but you want more than 30 seconds? Should I talk some more? How you serve the waiver populations, how do you allocate funds? If they overspend, it goes in the property tax. And so part of what we're attempting to do in the bill is to have these meetings where they could have an informal appeal about how much is given. They'd have flexibility about who they could serve, how they would, you know, pick the sites, and determine level of need. And then also in the bill is a three-point standard for determining. There's a group to work on this, based on first the first level of need is life and safety and, you know, and health, and the second level is more independence. And the third level is quality of life. I think that's said that correctly. And so as you build on those, maybe we should serve everybody at the basic level first and take care of those 4,000 people and then see what we can do about enhancing the quality of life. So that's the House proposal. And I'm sorry to spring on you, Ms. Aves. Do you feel like you're able to offer a few thoughts?
Mr. Chair and members, I don't think I can really say it any better than you have said it.
Maybe you want to point out what part of the bill it's in so people can read it.
Yes. It is in Article 7. And the language begins on page...
What else should we talk about?
R10, House Section 11. The Senate has some similar provisions. I think the main thing that was not mentioned is that the tribes are included in the new proposal. In the past, the tribes were not included as being able to become service delivery authorities.
Senator Hand, do you have any questions?
Mr. Chairman, and I'm just trying to...
Article 7.
Article 7.
Page R10. It's at line 290.25.
That's okay. Now, is the language identical?
Mr. Chair and members, parts of it are. The identical sections would be House Section 11, 12, 13, are identical to the three comparison Senate sections. The House provisions continue for several more sections.
Okay. So, Mr. Chairman, so in Section 14, for example, on page R13 is new. Section 15.
Section 14 is
Section 16, I guess. So those are all new provisions that the House has that the Senate does not have. And do you know, are there dollars associated with that additional language that you have put into your budget that is related to that? Or is
it's just policy? No?
Just a policy position?
There's no money tied to this. To the SDA stuff. Mr. Senator Hand, I don't think there's any money. This is county flexibility. And I'll have to tell you, every county flexibility that I thought made sense, we put into the bill because I thought that made a lot of sense.
Okay. And Mr. Chairman and members of the committee, we in the Senate, we did try to adopt some recommendations brought to us by county representatives to bring about some flexibility. Clearly, you've gone beyond what we did and the sections in the bill that reflect that. But again, we are certainly open to the idea. We tried to take the position that since there would be probably some reduction in the expected level of funding going to the counties, that we ought to try to do everything we can to allow them to use those funds more flexibly, to not necessarily dictate how it should be done, but to give them an opportunity to make decisions about that. We did take a provision in some of the grants that we combined and made into one grant. That's not directly related to this, but certainly willing to talk about that as well if there's wisdom to that or if that needs to be modified. But I think generally the idea that you're raising, that should we find ways to try to improve how counties do what they do and provide them greater degrees of flexibility, certainly I think the Senate would be favorable to that discussion and willing to make compromises on whatever language that facilitate that.
I appreciate that, Senator. Any other questions or comments from members? We have 15 minutes left, and we've exhausted our we can solve that by talking, but I have another thing to bring up. But go ahead, Representative Kiffmeyer.
No, I just thought, Mr. Chairman, that what I liked about our additional House language in this case was remedy failure to meet performance outcomes. And so I think it's very consistent with the language above at going on. And so not only giving them the flexibility, but also the power and the authority in regard, and the commissioner as well, for underperforming or so on. I think that's a good balance, because whenever you give additional authority or flexibility, that is that concern. And so I think that is a very good House position. Just wanted to speak to that.
Well, thank you.
Well, Mr. Chairman, I appreciate that, and as I said, we're certainly willing to work with the House on their provisions, and we are interested in trying to bring flexibility to the county process.
Very good. We have 15 minutes. I think that's enough time. Representative Gottwald, you don't know we're talking about this, but there's a House File 8 something or other. The House has the pilot version. The Senate expands it. And so maybe we could spend some time discussing that, the treatment of the – well, why don't you – the House has a – it's between 133 and 200. Is that right? So the Senate reps on a Gottwald. You want to, so if the Senate wants to just get ready to discuss its version of this, the health care side and the – what do we call it?
Minnesota.
The Healthy Minnesota.
The Healthy Minnesota Contribution Program.
Representative Gottwald, what is Healthy Minnesota in the House side?
Perhaps staff can direct us to where it is in the side-by-side. at least
Chair,
as a point of reference.
The House language. Mr. Chair, the House language would be in Article 5, House Section 94, and the corresponding Senate section would be Section 41, and then the section... The Senate has also a defined contribution program for medical assistance that's earlier in that article that I'll need to find. It's House Senate Section 33 would be the other related provision.
And what page, Mr. Chung?
You know what page it is, Mr. Chung?
The Senate provision, Senate Section 33 is on page R73 of Article 5. Then... the House and Senate Minnesota Care provisions are on page R93.
Okay, thank you. Representative Gottwald.
So, Mr. Chair, under the House position, at least, House File 8, in essence, it is privatizing a portion of Minnesota Care for those at 133% to, in the original position, House File 8, 250% with the cutback I believe our position is that we're taking that back down to 200%, so that people above 200% are not included. So it is between 133% and 200% adults without children. This is a population Minnesota has control of without requirement of any federal waivers. And the intent here is to provide a subsidy that is adjusted. There's a base rate, and then that is adjusted on a sliding fee schedule. For age and income. This is then combined with the amount that these people are currently paying in their share of premium for Minnesota Care to give them an amount to go to market with. They are then free to go and purchase a plan that they feel fits their needs best, individual policies in the private marketplace. We have demonstrated that these policies can range anywhere from $1,000 deductible to perhaps $2,000, $3,000 deductible. In many cases, the individual policies are going to purchase deductibles that apply mostly to not so much the primary and preventive care. That's covered $1 in almost every policy in the state of Minnesota, but to the things below inpatient. When you get into inpatient, when you're really sick and you need it, where this improves dramatically on Minnesota Care is we don't have the $10,000 inpatient cap that currently exists. Most people know that you can spend $10,000 on an inpatient hospitalization in a heartbeat. Originally, Minnesota Care was meant to apply to people only up to 150% of federal poverty guideline. That has been extended now to 250%, and some proposals have sought to go far beyond that. It is not a good package of care or a good program for people at those income levels. When you blow through that inpatient hospitalization maximum, you end up with people on personal bankruptcy, and then they have nothing. And that, in my mind, is a very irresponsible approach. Again, making promises we can't keep with money we don't have. The Health Care Access Fund that funds the current Minnesota Care Program is set to go bankrupt in 2013. So we don't have a way to pay for that program going forward. This provides sustainability to the Health Care Access Fund. Mr. Chair, there is also language in there that seeks waivers to apply this to families with children. We would need a federal waiver to do that. And there is place saver language. We've talked a lot about seeking broader waivers from the federal government around caring for lower income populations. And there is some place saver language in there in the House version that would ask us to seek that. Mr. Chair, there is also a provision. If people are denied care in the private insurance market, they of course have access to the Minnesota Comprehensive Health Association coverage, which is a great strength and a hallmark of Minnesota health care coverage. It's part of why we have so few people who are uninsured in this state. We have additional language that seeks to put a low-cost version, fairly high deductible option into MCHIP. Right now, part of the reason a lot of people do not sign up for MCHIP is that the options available under it are fairly costly. So it would direct the state or MCHIP to create a low-cost option. There is a brief place that recognizes that many veterans who seek coverage under Minnesota Care are not being identified and referred to the much better, more generous benefits, more appropriate benefits available to them under the VA, and simply states that they would be asked that when they're applying for Minnesota Care. The eligibility is the same, by the way. This preserves eligibility under Minnesota Care. We're not changing that at all, so this is not kicking anybody off. The department, in its fiscal note, suggested that because of a change, and only because it is a change, that some people might choose not to sign up for it. We've agreed that the number of those people is substantially less than what they'd originally predicted in a conversation with them. But it's acknowledged that some people might choose not to sign up because of the change, and only because of that, not because we're kicking them off. The eligibility is maintained. This, in the first full biennium, is projected to save about $100 million. In this initial biennium, I believe it's about $30 million. And I think, Mr. Chen, unless I've missed anything, that kind of covers most of the basics. By the way, this also provides, and this is not inconsequential, it provides commercial rates to providers. Hospitals and providers, we talk all the time about the fact that we underpay and cost shift as a result to the private marketplace because public programs underpay providers. And they complain about it a lot, and they have a right to. It decreases access to care for people on public programs because when they go to these providers, the providers say, well, we're not seeing you anymore because we can't afford to see you. This now moves this Minnesota care population on what could arguably be called a demonstration basis. These people will now be walking in with private commercial rate payments for providers and hospitals, which should increase their access and improve the financial picture for the providers that they see for care. And that's not inconsequential, Mr. Chair. I think that's very important. We need to begin moving in that direction to start making our providers and hospitals more whole on the services they're delivering for these populations.
Thank you very much. You want to give your pre-market speech again? any questions from the Senate about Senator Hamm?
Just a clarification, and Representative Gottwald was talking about the plan. I think you said it was for folks eligible up to 200% of federal poverty. And I'm just looking on page R94. It talks about the determination of defined contribution, and it refers to persons with household incomes equal to or greater than 250%. Is that?
Oh, Senator, the House reduced the Minnesota Care for adults to 200%. That's probably just an artifact.
Yes, Mr. Chair, you're correct that HFA originally anticipated this going from 133% to 250%. Elsewhere in our omnibus bill, our position, there was a reduction from 250 to 200% and eliminating them from eligibility. So,
and Mr. Chairman, I appreciate the this might be an appropriate time if we have a couple of minutes just to comment on the idea. This is, as you may know, an idea that Representative Gottwald and I have worked on, I guess, for the past 2 or 3 years in various iterations and others, particularly in the House. And I think in previous years, you've actually, the House adopted bills independently that reflect this. We've never been successful in having those proposals get a hearing over here in the Senate side. So,
Senator, this is the first bill it had more than a hearing.
More than a hearing.
So you're in good company.
But so this is an idea that at least a few of us in the Senate had been familiar with previous to this year. But and I'm happy to see that it is in your provision as well. Now, just with respect to at least briefly some of the differences, what we proposed in the Senate was to take the concept that Representative Gottwald has talked about and apply it more broadly under the understanding that even if someone be a person of lower income, that doesn't necessarily mean that that person is incapable of making good judgments about their health care or that they ought to be denied the opportunity to make decisions about what kind of health care they should have. So just to go back to page R94, in the side-by-sides, talking about the two programs. In the House, you're proposing to apply this to gross family income equal or greater than 133%. We have extended that down to 75% of the federal poverty guideline. So in the Senate position, what we're saying is if you're at 75% or below, you're in the CCDS structure. If you're at 75% and above, then you're in a defined contribution structure. And as going back to the earlier discussion we had, in my mind, those are not necessarily definitive measures. I think that the idea is to try to arrive at what is a sensible way to recognize that we want to try to maximize the opportunity for people to have ability to make decisions about health care. And for those who are, for whatever reason, incapable or unable, we want to have some other way to make sure that their needs are being cared for. So that, just as a comment, doesn't mean that that is a definitive or that it has to be that. But because of that, we've included a larger number of individuals in the scope of the plan. The other thing I'd point out, going back to the determination of contribution amounts further down on page R94, and we both have this sliding scale. We've got a table that begins on R95 that shows what those defined contribution amounts are per month, and they're identical. We've adopted the same payment structure. But we do recognize that there is a need to augment that structure at the lower end of the income range and perhaps diminish it slightly at the upper end. And so the differentiation or the breakdown of that sliding scale is a little bit different. If you look at page or line 110.7 in the Senate side, what we're saying is that if you're between 75 and 133%, then the defined contribution is increased by 10%, 110. On your side, I think you go to 150. Then if you're 75 to 100 in the Senate position, it's base, which is identical to what the House position is. If you're up to 250 in the Senate side, it's 80%. You've got 250 on the House side, although I understand you've and other places reduce that to 200. So there's similar structure here, mm-hmm. but it is a little bit different. And certainly on the Senate side, we've incorporated a larger number of people. That does affect the amount of dollars that are associated with this. And I may have to refer to Mr. Albrecht. I don't know if you've got it in your mind what this portion of the proposal results in savings. We've also got a similar structure for the Medicaid side in addition. And I don't know, Mr. Albrecht, do you recall what the breakdown is between those two in terms of, in total it's about, I believe, $600 million between both programs. Is that correct, Mr. Albrecht?
Mr. Albrecht.
I don't remember the percentage.
Mr. Chair, perhaps as Mr. Albrecht's looking up the number, I could also add, since we're on the topic of the sliding fee schedule, it's important to note we worked with some of the people who are advocates for mental health. who are concerned about mental health and chemical dependency coverage being included in whatever policy these people purchase. There is actually a disincentive, in other words, a reduction in the subsidy if they purchase a policy that does not include mental health or chemical dependency. That should be an incentive for these people to purchase a policy that includes that coverage. We've also added a 20% increase, I believe, in both the House and Senate position for people who would be denied in the private sector to help them afford the increase in cost for coverage available under the Minnesota Comprehensive Health Association. Again, coverage under the Minnesota Comprehensive Health Association is guaranteed issuance. They cannot be denied coverage. In that sense, really, Minnesota has a guaranteed issue system right now. We have some other reforms we'd like to do to kind of streamline that and make it work better, but that will probably be for a different time. But that kind of that helps flesh out the whole picture on how these subsidies work.
And Mr. Chair, and Representative, thank you for pointing that. You're right, and that's on page R96, the side by side, and that's where you do see that for the folks who do not pass through the underwriting process and end up in the MCHA, there's a 20% increase in the base contribution amount, and also that paragraph starting on 111.1 in the Senate side is the language that talks about if you purchase a policy that does not include that mental health and chemical dependency treatment, then the amount of the contribution is reduced by 5%. So there is a disincentive. Our thought is that people will want to take advantage of the maximum amount of potential contribution, and to do that, you would have to purchase a plan that allows for coverage of those issues. So I think that's a good point.
So we're running up on our time here. So just to summarize the Minnesota Care part, the House does 133 to 200 for adults. The Senate does 75 to 250 for all of them,
yes,
and then gets a waiver for the families and all. Just to, and it would be interesting if staff over the weekend could come up with just to compare. Ours is small, and if you can see it right in the spreadsheet, it's $29 million or $30 million or something. And just to see how the Senate breaks it out, just so we can know the different math questions.
What do you want to do?
What are the meetings? Okay. Right. And so we're, it's 10 o'clock. Where's the time gone? Went fast for us. Four of you all sitting on the chairs listening to this stuff. But I hope that you find these, I found this very productive, listening to the Senate views on what they've done and our, what we've done in some of our work. We are moving actually ahead. There'll be some amendments coming from the House next week when we're ready about some House language amendments. We've been having lots of meetings with lots of people about some of the technical changes. Those will be discussed next week. I'm not sure if it's the first or second meeting we'll do that. We've been alternating gavels by meeting. We're getting along really well at the Senate. And there's a joint rule that says it changes by day. We haven't felt any need to invoke that. We think that it's great to work with the Senate on getting this done. And
I love you, man.
Anyway, so the Senate's not clear what its schedule is going to be next week, and so we'll be certainly meeting next week sometime. I would predict at least by Tuesday. But there'll be a call to the chair, and you know how to read your emails and so on. So, Senator Hamm.
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chairman, and members of the committee and members of the public. Yes, we do not have finalized a date and time for the next meeting of this committee. And so it will be, we'll get that posted out here as soon as we can. It may not be Monday. We do have some other things in the House or Senate that we have to deal with. As was mentioned earlier, we're still dealing with policy in our committee, which is the same committee that's done the finance. So we do have a little bit of conflict with getting those things done as well. But it will be, we will anticipate having some meetings next week. And I would hope that we can start to think about adopting some common language and perhaps beginning some work on trying to reach some agreement on some of the issues that we may have even talked about today, where we can begin to say how do we bridge the gap between the House and Senate position on things that we have broad agreement on, for example, CCDS as one issue, but there are others, and begin to start to work to try to find a way to reach a compromise that we both could agree with.
Representative Gottwell.
Mr. Chair, just real quickly, I know we've all been receiving communications from various groups advocating, and I know all of these things are very serious and important. Many of the communications I've received are about what people are against, either in the Senate position or the House position. I think it would also be helpful to hear from them about what they think is good or could be worked with or where they think this could be improved so we can start being constructive about how we work towards a final solution. So I would just offer that that invitation, not a challenge, but an invitation to various groups to weigh in on what they think is good or workable or something that they're willing to work with in this.
And just to follow up on that, I want to thank the people that have been chatting with us. You don't have to just talk to the lead. We're all conferees here and chat with staff. We're about solving a problem, making something that we can you don't want to have them talk to you? Okay. Well, talk to most staff, anyway. Yeah, just don't talk to Mr. Albrecht. Sorry. Sorry. Anyway, so have a nice weekend. We'll see you next week. We're adjourned.